This is the Senate Criminal Law and Procedure Committee, Wednesday, March 10, 1971, 3 p.m. in 215 State Capitol Building. Today's agenda, Senate Bill 40, Articles 23, 24, and 25.
Please come to order. We want everyone to notice that our project director is here on time today. In fact, he is 10 minutes early to make up for 10 minutes. Before we start, I want to read into the record a letter I received from the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and this is a resolution that they adopted at the last convention, whereas there's pending legislation on the criminal law revision for the state of Oregon, and whereas we feel there is a need for the criminal law revision for the state of Oregon, now therefore be it resolved that the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police is opposed to Article Number 4, but do endorse the concept of Senate Bill 40 with reservation to some section. Turn that letter over to the clerk.
I think you ought to point out that that's the old Article 4.
Yes, I wanted to make that very clear. That is the old Article 4, before it was amended. I also would like to point out that we have amended Article 4, and you have in front of you copies of the amended article, which we are going to distribute to every member of the legislature. This is Article 4 as amended. In case they have any questions. Okay, we turn to Article 23. Jason, related senator Don.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our discussion today starts with page 72 of Senate Bill 40 and page 192 of Book. Here again, follow the pattern or format that is utilized in the code, and each article we attempt to have comprehensive definitions in the first section of the article, and then use those in the statement of the crime to follow. With respect to the seven definitions that appear in section 189, contraband will become important to these sections with respect to prohibiting contraband that was brought in to correctional facilities and whatnot. Under sub 2, correctional facility, you see a reference there. Correctional facility does not include a juvenile training school and applies to the same hospital only as a person detained therein, charged with or convicted of a crime, detained therein after acquittal of a crime by reason of mental disease or defect. Section 3653. Now, I want to strictly point out those sections deal with the responsibility article. We're talking about persons who have been committed to a state hospital because of a criminal type commitment. It's necessary to see that to draw a distinction between a correctional facility and the other kinds of facilities, such as juvenile training school and state hospital, where you have a person there as a result of civil commitment.
Don, Ted Allen's been doing for years about having something in there for a state, not juvenile training school, but juvenile training home for a state. You think that should go like in the juvenile home and that sort of thing?
Well, I do. We felt in the first place that when we're talking about escape here, we're talking about criminal offenses, and that we did not want to make it a criminal offense to leave a place where you were an inmate and you weren't a criminal to start with. Although we do have a section that prohibits aiding someone to escape or to unlawfully depart from certain institutions. But my answer would have to be yes, if you're talking about some kind of special sanction that is placed on an individual to leave a kind of facility. Although we recognize and point out that if there are any other crimes committed in the process, out that we should continue the present means of distinguishing between persons confined to really a correctional facility, such as a penitentiary, or a jail, and persons that strictly in the case of juveniles who are in a training school. The most important definition in section 189 is under sub 4, and that is the definition of escape itself. We define it as meaning the unlawful departure of a person from custody or a correctional facility. And you'll see that by including a correctional facility as it's defined under sub 2, we specifically exclude the juvenile training school. Now, the definition here of custody under sub 3 refers expressly to both actual and as well as constructive restraint. And we intend thereby to apply the same rule to restraint imposed in a correctional facility, that is, an inmate considered confined in a correctional facility from the time of original commitment until discharge, whether he's physically present in the actual facility or not, would be under the constructive custody. And it would consider the same type of escape under those situations as if he had actually been inside the physical structure itself. Now, presently under Oregon law, we have the ORF 162-322. We have the definition of escape, official detention. We have a statute now, 162-340, which prohibits aiding an inmate in the state institution to escape. And they specify seven state institutions. We would repeal these statutes, but we would replace them with comparable coverage in this article. Application of these definitions that are set out in section 189 does work some change in existing law. For example, escape from civil arrest and escape from custody based upon a court order will be punishable. But a juvenile will not be chargeable for escape from a juvenile training school, although he will be, as I mentioned earlier, liable for any intense criminal activity that might commit the process. Now, moving into the substantive sections themselves, beginning with section 190, escape in the third degree applies to persons in custody on either a misdemeanor or felony charge who escape without resort to force or use of a weapon. Now, you'll notice that it's escape from custody. Now, custody, again, means the imposition of actual or constructive restraint pursuant restraint by a peace officer pursuant to an arrest or court order. It does not include detention in a correctional facility. The simple reason is we treat that as a more serious offense to escape from the facility than to escape from custody. We allow a defense here to escape in the third degree if he was in custody pursuant to an illegal arrest.
How would a civilian know whether he was in custody? How would I know?
You might not know. You might suspect that you are. Whether you really were would be a question to be determined later.
I thought we were shooting at you while you were
running. Sure, and he might well be shooting at you while you were running. We're just saying that would be a defense to a later prosecution for the crime of escape if it did in fact turn out to be an unlawful arrest. That's all.
If you live through it, you've got to defend.
But as we mentioned earlier in our sections, we were talking about discouraging, resisting arrest. We were trying to discourage resisting arrest. We have a specific section that we will get to, which makes the separate crime to forcibly resist an arrest, whether it's lawful or unlawful. But here we're talking about what in effect would be a walk away kind of escape.
Representative Paul.
Yes, we define that in our general definition.
Criminal code has it too. I don't, maybe what you're saying So what I hear you saying is that we ought to underscore it.
Well, but here's the city language. I think that's what I know he's doing good. I probably don't want in prayer, but
I think we have. We have.
Well, I think you're saying rather than using deadly weapons, they're done.
Or deadly weapons. It seems to me that someday, if there's any merit to the defense about not having firearms readily available, that we have to recognize in our system, but we don't. And apparently, we didn't have that testimony, or we're making some other new codes that didn't.
Well, we felt certainly that any time a gun is used, it makes the crime more serious. And our definition, that's why we have two separate definitions with respect to weapons. We define them as general definitions, a deadly weapon, which includes the gun and the kind of thing that's specifically designed to be a weapon. And throughout the code, we have said either being armed with a deadly weapon or using or threatening to use a dangerous weapon, which is a club or any number of things that become a weapon because the use they're put to. Throughout the code, we have tried to underscore the feeling that this is a serious matter, makes it more serious. Our assault in the first degree, burglary in the first degree, robbery in the first degree, escape in the first degree, all point out that this is looked upon as a more serious crime because of the presence of the weapon. And so we certainly did take it into account, and the commission spent a great deal of time trying to underscore this. Although we don't have a specific general section that says it's more serious to use a gun, by the way we define the crimes in which they come into play, we have built in. Certain kinds of knives would, under our definition of a deadly weapon, be a deadly weapon. Other kinds of knives, for example, a kitchen knife or a steak knife or something such as that, you wouldn't normally think of as a weapon, would not be a deadly weapon. And so in other words, if you were arrested and you had a kitchen knife on you, it wouldn't make it a first-degree robbery. But if you took that kitchen knife and attempted to use it as a weapon, then it does become first-degree robbery. But now, as you can see, that here are the proposed grading scheme going from a Class A misdemeanor all the way up to a Class B felony. Uses the basic rationale here of the risk to others created by the escape. And we felt that the least risk is presented by a person charged with a misdemeanor, or it could be a felony, who escape prior to being incarcerated in a facility and who do not resort to the use of force, in other words, the walk away. And here it's important to note that we're talking about a person who is in custody, whereas we're not talking about a person who's in custody who has been convicted or found guilty. under the second degree, we felt that escape from a correctional facility that it shows increased planning and premeditation and also threatens the security of the correctional facility, increases the risk of other things, perhaps riots or escape by other persons from the facility. Also, that a person convicted of a felony is more apt to create harmful consequences by an escape. And furthermore, that a convicted felon results in have more incentive to escape and that a greater deterrent to escape was required. And then, of course, the use of force, the hazards inflicted in that are fairly obvious. Now, the proposed section that we have later on, section 206, denies the person the right to resist by force and arrest, whether it is legal or illegal. Right now, we are being accelerates the conflict, and that the person is subjected to what later turns out to be an unlawful arrest. He has ample recourse otherwise than fighting him out in the street. but in the judgment of the commission, the same rationale does not apply to section 190 of the even third degree. Here it does not involve force, and if force should be used, then the case then becomes a more serious crime. Question was asked of me by one of the district attorneys last week to do with respect to the work release program for persons who failed to return. ORS 144-500 now provides that the unauthorized absence of a person from the work release program constitutes an abuse of official detention. We specifically retain this section 340 of your bill, which appears on page 131 of the bill, make some amendments to conform with changes in the proposed code. The substance is not changed, and that you still be in escape. The new language agrees that the person who fails to return from work release constitutes an escape from a correctional facility under section 191 of the again, it's a question of recognizing whether or not to construct these custody and correctional facilities. Section 193, unauthorized departure. And here, now we're talking about persons detained in juvenile training schools and state hospitals. Who, because of the nature of their commitment, are not considered to be within a correctional facility. However, Section 193 does make it a crime to aid a person to make what we call an unauthorized departure. We specifically use that language again in an attempt to distinguish between that and an escape. It's graded as a Class A misdemeanor. Section 194, supplying contraband.
State hospitals, are they all in custody? They can't leave? State hospitals are general terms. There isn't any hospital where you have free to leave.
Well, there are state hospitals where I assume they have freedom to move with respect to being released from visitation. Oh, sure, they can do that, and we're not, this would not amount to an escape anyway, pardon me?
It's greater or better.
Yeah, in other words, this would get the person who was not authorized to leave in the first place. It's an unauthorized departure, and he was aided in some way by a third person. Supplying contraband, here it's important that with respect to culpability required is one of knowingly, therefore it would require proof that the person supplying the contraband knew that it was contraband, and rather than try to go through and list what would be an extremely difficult, not impossible, list of different kinds of articles that might be contraband with respect to the internal operation of an institution. We felt that this was the type of thing that should be controlled by the administrators of the particular institution. So we do not define contraband beyond what we say under sub 1 of section 189, which is a very broad definition. It means any article or thing which a person can find in the correctional facility, juvenile training school, or state hospital is prohibited by statute, rule, regulation, or order from obtaining or possessing, and whose use would endanger the safety or security of such institution and person therein. Obviously, certain things come to mind, such as weapons and
lawful person
speak for themselves.
Representative Paul, please.
Under the existing circumstances, now that I've seen after that, I mean, Center Street, you can get more goats inside the hospital than you can on the street, which is bringing on weekends where everybody else does, and it's just, it's not the band. Getting the system, if you look to that, it's pretty, pretty bad situation, what is out there now.
Sure, we recognize that probably the drug situation is one of the most critical, and of course, this definition of supplying contraband not only is an attempt to get at the person who brings it in, but it would also authorize separate charges against the inmate for the person confined in possesses it or maybe is supplying it to others. And it's a two-pronged approach. We're not suggesting this is going to solve all the problems with respect to controlling the introduction of contraband, but it does provide some kind of sanction. Although we would expect that within the internal operation of the institution, as far as the inmates are concerned, this would be, in most cases, control through disciplinary action within the institution rather than bringing separate charges. But it would authorize, under Section 194, where we say being confined in a correctional facility, juvenile training school, or state hospital, knowingly may contain or possess.
Good. Yeah. Senator Brown.
Is contraband defined in here, or is it well defined by state law?
It's not defined other than the definition we've given to it here.
189.
And we mentioned also that there are regulations, for example, with the juvenile training schools, Chapter 420. Care centers, penal and correctional institutions, mental health institutions, et cetera, have authority to determine what is contraband. Although we are not writing new statutes or proposing new statutes in other chapters, we point out that municipal and county correctional facilities should likewise adopt procedures for providing notice, and some of them already do, like the county jails that have notice support, as to what is prohibited contraband, so that persons would be put on notice if they should not bring certain articles into the institution.
Sure, I think you saw a joke when I spoke about one book, Mr. Miller, but especially if people have the children in prison and have them on notice. And on line 3 of page 73, the word and, it means it has to both be prohibited and also has to endanger the safety. And that's what I understand that.
And whose use would endanger the safety or security?
Well, if the warden says you can't have law books and have law books and that doesn't endanger anybody, it doesn't become that. It's very similar to rule making, but it doesn't become
that. Right. And of course, we're talking here now for the purposes of a criminal prosecution. We're not talking about the discipline or what sanctions may be imposed within the authority of the superintendent of the respective
And the person would have to know what he introduced into the jail was contraband.
So, with respect to Section 194, we feel that it represents new law in two respects. One, that there is no existing criminal statute that applies directly to attempting to penal law to control this kind of thing. And also that we do cover not only penal institutions, but contraband in the juvenile schools as well as state hospitals.
Then, in the juvenile charge, decide as you do.
Well, here again, he might and he might not. He could end up being remanded to adult court, depending on his age and time, as he's older. It might be too handled as an under juvenile matter.
As in any other offense.
Now, sections 195 and 196, bail jumping in the second degree and first degree, apply not only persons out on bail, but also persons out on the ROR, release on their own cognizance. Requires an intentional failure to appear, and we were meaning to exclude from additional criminal liability negligent failure to appear. These two sections restate what was basically existing law in ORS 162-460. Procedurally, Chapter 140 governs the method by which persons are released on bail or recognizance, and those would not be affected, as well as sections of existing law dealing with citations in lieu of bail. Those likewise would not be affected. Bail jumping in the second degree is a misdemeanor, and of course here, the original charge is either a misdemeanor or a violation, whereas bail jumping in the first degree becomes a Class C felony because the original charge in which he jumped bail was a felony, comparable to the way the existing statute covers. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman, on this particular item.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Brown.
In Section 194, applying contraband, when it's such a broad range of contraband from a package of cigarettes to a gun, isn't it pretty stiff to be for a package of cigarettes or a bottle of whiskey to make it a Class II felony?
Well,
for instance, the guy that had ended up in the room decided to go to the computer for the inmate.
And we talked about having two grades of offense and trying to distinguish between what we felt would be the more serious kind of contraband with the less serious. And the commission was of the opinion that a Class B felony under our grading system gives the court authority to treat it as a misdemeanor anyway. And that rather than trying to distinguish on the basis of the type of article or item introduced, we should just have one statute, make it a Class C felony, and then the discretion of the court, it could be treated as a misdemeanor. And furthermore, we felt that that you'd have to show that the contraband did present some danger to the safety and security of the institution. And I suppose with a pack of cigarettes, you'd argue, well, they may burn down the place or something like that. And all these things kind of really question facts.
That'd be pretty far fetched. You'd have a lot of credit in the fact that they need to live in the other.
That's right. But the court wouldn't, under our Class B felony provision, have to admit to the office.
Any other questions? If you want to see your name down.
Yeah. Department. First of all, we think that what the committee has done in sections 193, 194, 195, 6, 192 is really necessary and gives the jails the protection I think they should have. Where we've had some difficulties, and let me discuss what we have in section 190 and 191. First, right off the bat, I think the distinction that the committee and the revisers made in bail jumping is a logical one. If you jump bail on a misdemeanor or a violation charge, that's only a misdemeanor. If you jump bail on a felony, then that's a felony. And we think the same rationale should apply to escape in sections 190 and 191. The policeman brought out examples under section 190, which deals with on-the-street arrest. That's all it can deal with, because if you're in a correctional facility, then it's second degree escape. The police right now in the city of Portland are having a large degree of difficulty in effecting on-the-street arrests where they try not to resort to any force, where they simply try to place the person under arrest. And I think most of the committee members are well acquainted with what it requires to accomplish a legal arrest in this state. And there must be some actual restraint of the individual. He must either be physically restrained or he must have submitted to custody voluntarily. Without those two things existing, you don't have an arrest. Now, if that in fact exists and the man breaks and runs, and if in fact he has been arrested on a felony, the police feel that that is serious enough to be treated as a potential felony, a Class C misdemeanor, Class C felony. For that reason, we're asking that you consider, in your definition under subsection 1 and section 190, it appears on the bottom of page 73 of the printed bill, and page 194 in the proposal, that after the word custody, where the period appears, you add, for a misdemeanor, on a misdemeanor or violation arrest, to recognize the fact the misdemeanor and the violation is treated as a less serious, a less life-threatening, a less forcible situation, which is in keeping with the basic distinctions you made as you revised the criminal law. And to section 191, in subsection B, before the word convicted, you add the word arrested. For this reason, and let me give you a for instance, and I'll stop, because lawyers are great for instances. You have placed under arrest this chair, let's say you said you're under arrest for murder in the first degree. A pat-down frisk of the man indicates he's unarmed. And you say, sit in the back seat of the patrol car while I radio for additional assistance. You put him down in the back seat of the patrol car, and then he breaks and runs. Should that man have committed only a misdemeanor? Or should he have committed a situation where the court would be able to treat it as a Class C felony? The police think it should be treated as a Class C felony. If he, in fact, has been arrested, and if the arrest is for a felony. And I think, and the committee thinks in Portland, that this is a logical distinction. If all he's committed is a misdemeanor, then that's all he should be guilty of. He breaks and runs without using any force. If he has, in fact, been arrested for a felony, the committee in Portland feels that the court should have the option to treat him in its discretion as a misdemeanor or a felony. The subsection 2 of section 190, the committee felt, and I read the commentary again and again in the proposed code, that the rationale that prohibits a person in a correctional institution from litigating the legality of his confinement by breaking out, such as the fugitive from a television series, should be just as applicable to a person who's being arrested on the street. In other words, he should not be able to adjudicate on the street whether or not he's been legally arrested or not, or whether the arrest itself is illegal, that he should reserve that to the courtroom. The civil remedies, as evidenced in our federal court, in Portland alone, are more than adequate to compensate a person for whatever damage has been suffered to his reputation, if in fact he has been illegally arrested, as Kent Ford, the local chairman of the Black Panther Party, proved that by getting an $8,000 judgment against two Portland City police officers for illegal arrest and physical abuse of them. And the police would ask that that be the place that the question of the illegality of an arrest be resolved, and not leave it up to the person himself to judge in his own peril. I think in the 20th century that our police agencies are intelligent enough and responsible enough that this type of subsection is really not a step forward. Instead is a recognition of something that we hope has been removed from the police department, and that is the specter of the illegal arrest. And juries are very very sympathetic to a person who has been illegally arrested if he can prove it. That basically consists of the commentary that I would have to add. The police are concerned in Portland that subsection 2 is section 190, and the fact that it applies to all degrees of crime from the lowest grade of violation to the highest offense under the code, first degree murder, is to them not recognizing what they think to be a pretty serious situation. Obviously, the little kid who's been arrested, the 18-year-old, for stealing a pack of cigarettes, should not be treated as a felon if he breaks away from the officer and runs. But the person who's just committed an armed robbery, the officer has fished a loaded revolver out of his pocket, therefore disarming the man and not making him a violent threat anymore. That man turns and breaks and runs. They kind of thought that of course you have the option to treat him as a felon if he escapes.
You had those four amendments.
Yes, and they're written for me.
Right.
The other question that our committee had was answered by Don in the commentary, and that was with respect to word belief. We wanted to make sure that that hadn't been inadvertently admitted after hearing Don's commentary. As a whole, the entire article is a good article. And I, in mentioning that, I think Representative Paul brought this up, and Senator Brown. The regulations of the institution, you can rest assured, would be challenged if they were not based on a reasonable relationship to the safety or security of the institution. And you can rest assured that it would be the burden of the state in each of those instances to prove that the regulations are in fact related and related reasonably to that security or the institution or the individuals and so on. I can guarantee that would be true in my home country. But I think it would have been very good.
Thank you. Article 24.
All right, Article 24, really a companion article in this area, obstructing governmental administration. Again, under Section 197, we have five basic definitions. All really which would be new definitions in our law. We have under Section 198, obstructing governmental administration, the basic section in this article. And here it provides the person commits a Class A misdemeanor by committing the crime of obstructing governmental administration if he intentionally obstructs, impairs, or hinders the administration of law or other governmental function by means of intimidation, force, physical interference, or obstacle. Section 198 here requires that the conduct will manifest by threat, violence, or physical interference. And this is a limitation that recognizes certain constitutional safeguards, such as freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. And the general rule, we pointed out in the commentary, the words obstruct, resist, or oppose. The offense of resisting an officer can be committed without the employment of actual violence or direct force. Now, subsection 2 exempts two kinds of interference from the coverage of this section. The first is, here again, is interference with unlawful action of a public servant. The test here is an objective one and not based on what the person believes as to whether or not it's valid or lawful action. However, the illegality question is not recognized under the crime of resisting arrest. It's not recognized under the article on the section of justification article. It provides that you can't resist by force an arrest. Peace officer. So the upshot of this section really is that it's limited to obstructive threats, and the use of intimidation is not specifically prohibited unless it creates an unlawful obstruction of governmental process. Once you get into intimidation and some of these other things, coercive threats, such as that, might be getting into some of the prohibitions. Or possibly extortion, but those are different crimes. Section 199, refusing to assist a peace officer, up person commits a crime here, if he refuses to assist a peace officer against a command by a person known by him to be a peace officer, and reasonably refuses or fails to assist in effecting an authorized arrest or preventing another from committing a crime. This is graded very low. It's graded as a violation and be punishable by a maximum of $250 fine. Criminal liability here would not be imposed upon a person if the refusal is reasonable. We felt that we could not set out all the things that were either reasonable or unreasonable, and that it would not impose an absolute requirement to obey a command, and here again would be a question of fact as to whether or not it was a reasonable or an unreasonable action on the part of the individual. This section would repeal one existing criminal statute, the 162.530. There are some other related statutes that are not affected by this section, but we did talk about and consider in the justification article. Section 200 is the counterpart section refusing to assist in firefighting operations. And there is an existing statute that prohibits obstructing firefighting equipment or personnel, 476.750, 477.370 prohibits an able-bodied man from refusing to assist fire warden in firefighting. These two sections would be repealed by section 200, which broadens it to the degree that it covers all firefighting operations. Here again, this is graded as a violation. Section 201, bribing a witness. And section 202, bribery deed by a witness. Again, it was a question on the part of the commission, the value judgment, the purpose of the structure of the code, whether we place it here or in the bribery article. We felt that witnesses were not public servants, although when you're serving the witnesses, doing a public service, but under our definition of public servants, they did not seem to lodge to accept within the bribery article. This is a section 201. We're talking about bribery with, by means of a pecuniary benefit. Pecuniary benefit. Back in section 1878, and then one official proceeding, which appears in the previous article also, is no official proceeding. We redefined it. We redefined it here in section 197. These are really counterparts to the section dealing with bribery and bribery received by public servants. There's no existing statute now that deals directly with bribe taking or bribe receiving by a witness. With respect to witnesses, of course, the subordination of perjury could include a bribe situation, or it might not. If bribery involves a witness here, covered by this section, if it was a subordination of perjury or an actual perjury situation, then the witness itself would be subject to the perjury article. The subordination of perjury would be covered under our inchoate crimes article, which would be solicitation of a person to commit a criminal offense.
Is juror covered, or was it covered earlier?
Juror is covered, yes, under the bribery article.
It was pretty hard to determine whether to place some of these into a bribery article or obstructing justice. We felt the jury probably was better placed under the bribery section.
Section 203 now covers another improper conduct involving witnesses. Mentioned earlier, the previous sections deal with witness bribery, whereas 203 covers instances in which a witness is induced to other than if some pecuniary bribe of some sort. Section, and here again, we don't have an existing Oregon statute directly in point. We have criminal contempt provisions under existing law that could get at this kind of conduct that we're not supposed to interfere with the parent contempt powers of the court. We did want to provide some provision in the criminal code to make the criminal tampering with physical evidence complements the other sections here designed to protect against intentional subversion of official proceedings. With respect to physical evidence, which is used in the section on tampering with physical evidence, means any article, object, record, document, or other evidence of physical substance. New in Oregon law, but certainly there's ample support in the common law and in current legal authorities for this kind of criminal sanction. Now, under paragraph B of subsection 1, I should mention, knowingly made produced or offered any false physical evidence. Prosecutor here would have to show both knowledge of the falsity and an intent that it be used, introduced, or rejected in pending or prospective official proceedings. Consistent with our overall rejection of the defense responsibility, here we do not require physical evidence to be admissible as a matter of law as evidence, or that it be material evidence. Section 205 is designed to tampering with public records. Here we're concerned with maintaining the integrity of government administration. We're not trying to protect possible victims of all the records. The further use of falsified records made when you get into fraudulent conduct, perhaps attempt to theft. And this type of thing. Here we're talking about actually tampering with the public records in some manner or falsely making it or otherwise without authority interfering with the governmental process. Now, section 206 is a new section in Oregon law. We think a very important one, and we think one that is required and is needed by law enforcement. It was excluded from the obstructing governmental administration section because it's specifically covered here under existing arrest. And it's limited to the use or threatened use of physical violence or other acts producing a substantial risk of physical injury. Now, you'll notice that drafted in terms that would cover not only a person resisting his own arrest, but taking such action that in effect resists the arrest of a third person. And again, we specifically provided that it is no defense to a prosecution under this section that the peace officer lacks legal authority to make the arrest, provided he's acting in the color of his official authority. Now, here, made a separate substance offense, and contrary to the rationale, or really I should say consistent with the rationale we used in the escape law, we're concerned with forcible acts, pre-confrontations, and that type of thing in Canada, whereas under escape of a third degree, we're talking about a walk-away situation. Runaway where no threat or force is used. We have subsection 3 does depart from the common law and what as of right now is the prevailing view, and that is the right to resist an unlawful arrest. And not only talks about escape, a peaceful escape, but actually resist by force an unlawful arrest. The prevailing view has generally allowed reasonable resistance to an unlawful arrest on the grounds of self-defense. We should prohibit, however, the forcible resistance of arrest, and that the law is moving in this direction. Consistent with some of the statements made by Mr. Barton, although I do disagree with respect to the escape of third degree. I think there is a rational and reasonable difference here with respect to the question of whether there is a danger or a threat of injury or force being used. Section 207, hindering prosecution. This would replace the statutes which now talk about accessories after the fact. The culpability requirement here is an intent to hinder the apprehension, prosecution, conviction, or punishment of a person who has committed a felony. Now, one thing I would like to discuss a little bit here, a question that we discussed not only in the commission, but in three meetings I had with the Criminal Law Committee of the Bar. Question was brought up whether the language was so broad that it would make what we would think of would be reasonable and legitimate activity by an attorney representing a client who has committed or been charged with the crime. The consensus of the bar committee was recommended and specifically approved this article and recommended to the Oregon State Bar, the endorsement by the bar of the proposed code was that there was no danger of legitimate action by lawyers brought within the purview of this section on hindering prosecution. If we tried to cover every type of activity that would assist a person who's been committed committed a crime known as punishable as a felony, which covers your class C felonies as well. Harboring and concealing, warning him of intending discovery, aiding with money, disguise, weapons, etc. Prevents or obstructs by means of force, intimidation, anyone from performing an act which might aid in the discovery or apprehension of such person. Here you might have some overlap perhaps with the section on resisting arrest. However, you'll notice that we're talking about persons who are charged with felony crime, whereas your resisting arrest is covered. Graded as a class B felony, and I might mention existing statutes here, 161-240, provides that accessory shall be punished, et cetera, by prison sentence for not more than 5 years, or by prison to county jail for an incitable misdemeanor, and we have comparable coverage as a class B felony. Section on compounding. We're talking about compounding a felony. And here, a person agrees or accepts any pecuniary benefit to refrain from reporting to law enforcement authorities the commission or suspect the commission of any felony. This section is basically a restatement of existing law, ORS 162.310. Statutes in Chapter 134 dealing with civil compromise at certain times is not affected by the section. Section 209, we continue related not only to hindering but also to compounding, providing no defense to prosecution for either of those charges, that the principal offender is not apprehended, prosecuted, convicted, section basically restates existing law. Section 210, simulating legal process, is basically designed to discourage the use of misleading documents in the debt collection process, sending out or issuing documents that appear either civil or criminal process. ORS 165, 265, use of false pretense and collecting debt will be appealed under section. Section 211, criminal impersonation. A person commits a crime here if with intent to obtain a benefit or to injure or defraud another, he falsely impersonates a public servant and doesn't act in such an assumed character. Make that a class A misdemeanor. And we note in our commentary, a few of the penal codes require that only the false pretense be made. The majority of the statutes require that not only do you have the false pretense, but you have some act done in furtherance of it. This section follows the majority and requires that the impersonator do some act in the assumed character of the public servant that he's impersonating. Some states limited to law enforcement, peace officers, we would cover all public servants. Section 212, initiating a false report. Here, a person commits a crime, he knowingly initiates a false alarm or report, which is transmitted to the fire department, law enforcement agency, or other organization dealing with emergencies involving danger to life or property. The only statute that is affected directly by this existing law is the statute prohibiting false fire alarms, 476740, which would be repealed as much as we don't cover by this. The broader coverage is section 212. The last section in this article, unlawful legislative lobbying, is basically a restatement of ORS 162520. We've made some minor style changes so it can conform with the format of the new code. Please want to comment on this particular article, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions?
This particular section would not cover it, no. I think with respect to our article on riot disorderly conduct, we do have, I think, sections that do cover this kind of thing. Either disorderly conduct or harassment. As far as the crime of resisting arrest, first of all, for him to come under this section at all, he has to have some force involved. If your hypothetical would be closer to escaping third degree, where you could argue that it was an unlawful arrest and no force was involved.
Senator Carson had a question.
Don, why did on 207, line 10 of the bill, do we limit the hindering of prosecution only to felonies?
Why don't we make all crimes? 207.
Does a person commit the crime of hindering prosecution if with intent to hinder the apprehension, prosecution, conviction, or punishment of a person who has committed a crime, then we've added punishable as a felony. Why did we add punishable as a felony?
Well, we added punishable as a felony to make sure that the Class C felony was covered, even though, say, the person who was charged might later be treated as a Class A misdemeanor. But we limited it because we were trying to continue the coverage with respect to accessories after the fact. Commission felt that we should not extend it with respect to assisting persons after the fact of misdemeanors. This was a specific policy decision on the part of the commission, and that your accessories now are defined who, after the commission of a felony, conceal or aid the offender. So accessories after the fact now do not cover accessories after the fact of persons charged or persons who have committed misdemeanors. We did not want to extend it into the misdemeanor area.
Is there any particular reason for that, other than the fact we have done in the past? What I was thinking about is, the question brought to my attention, and I'm hard-pressed I don't know that we want to make it a Class C felony for hindering the apprehension of a misdemeanor. I grant you that. But what happens if I stand in the way? I think you're going to tell me to look back under resist arrest. If this being a fence, I guess. What happens when you're about to arrest Mr. Paulus and I intentionally stand in front of the knife, not violently or whatever, but I allow her to duck out the back door? What kind of language are you? And she's a misdemeanor. She's allegedly a misdemeanor. Am I guilty of any crime? She's stolen a hubcap off your car. Interfering with a police officer,
it's a felony, then
you are guilty of a crime. You're hindering. But if it's a class. Class A misdemeanor, petty theft, up to $150. Guy just came in and did theft. He wouldn't be armed because that's a felony. But could have theft of some sort, shoplifting. And the officer's about to make the apprehension. You stand in front of it, shut the door, or lock the door, drive your car in front of his.
How about a failing to stop at a stop sign?
Yeah.
At your home, the officer's coming, so you better get out of here. So he's coming after you're failing to stop at a stop sign. We had difficulty in the degrees of misdemeanors because we'd be opening the door up so much to put it under here that it wouldn't be worth it.
Well, I think it ought to be somewhere. I won't fight to the death putting it under here, but it seems to me that this might be a... I'm just surprised we don't have something like that in the law now. I grant you, I know how we got here because we're talking about accessory after the fact. And that historically is a key point that I'm not going to tell me. But we've tried so hard to on the resisting arrest and these other cases to not allow the citizen to make the decision of whether they ought to participate or not participate. He's supposed to go along with the officer and we'll fight the battle in court. Talk about that. And I think there are distinctions between the felon and misdemeanor. I just assume that the officer draws a distinction. And if he's going to prosecute if somebody picked him off on a parking ticket, I doubt that they'll do that.
Well, of course, as far as the resisting arrest and the escape, we're talking again and all through there about force. Forcible confrontations are used, physical force against the officer, and this kind of stuff. And I think another feeling here was that the law up to now has seemed to function all right with respect to the accessories after the fact kind of situation where you're limiting the felony. There just didn't seem to be that much of a need when we're talking about misdemeanors to try to scoop up a bunch of other people in the process. That if it became serious enough, it became a riotous kind of situation, or force was involved, or the became an assault upon the officer. There are any number of other ways to get at the serious kind of conduct, but if I just stood in front of you, I mean, if I tripped you, that might.
Well, I think it's implying, maybe I'm making a mountain of a hole, but it's implying it's legal to help a misdemeanor avoid prosecution, and it's illegal to help a felon. And I just can't, the argument that it's too much trouble, or that's not your argument, but don't mess with the little stuff. We haven't brought that anywhere on the code so far. And it seems that we're declaring it legal to interfere with it, or to accessorize the fact that any misdemeanor is trying to be in class A.
I don't think you'd be divorced, but I may offer an amendment.
Any further questions? Mr. Barton, did you have comments on this question?
Basically, not much. First of all, you know, we found in major trials frequently that the changing of dollars between hands as punishable now as the post code and the present code as bribery isn't a real problem. I think we count one finger. Number of actual paid-off witnesses that we've ever been able to detect and punish. The real problem that we face is the intimidation. You know, if you come to court, you're going to get battery acids thrown in your face. This is a real threat, or we'll take your kids away, or you won't have a home when you come home. Put sugar in your gas tank. And they go ahead and do some of these things. That's why we'd ask this committee here, give some consideration where, for instance, under Section 204 and hampering of physical evidence, where the actual use of force is intimidation or deception against the person to prevent them from producing physical evidence is utilized. And no matter what the offense be, that's still only punishable as a five-day misdemeanor. I realize that Section 203 does not contemplate that with respect to preventing them from appearing. But that members of the committee is the real problem. People don't appear because they've been paid off. They don't appear because they're scared. And they're scared to death because they've gotten threats from someone. And in cases that draw a lot of attention from our vocal minority group, be they black or white, this is a definite distinct problem. People who are afraid. Now, the federal government has recognized this in the fact that they now have statutes that permit the Attorney General to ship a witness out of state, put him up, provide for his family, support him for as long as may be necessary to protect him from retaliation. Look at Eddie Harris in Portland, the state's one of the state's key witnesses in the Capitan murder trial. Eddie was killed the same way that Mendoza, the victim in the Capitan case, was. His body was discovered in January in Idaho, 6 bullets in the head. Capitan, the man whose case he figured prominently in, was convicted of being the man who left the contract in the Mendoza case, and Mendoza himself was found dead with a bullet in the head. And Eddie Harris was told by every underworld figure he had, and he was a member of the underworld, his fate was going to be the same, and they caught up with him about a year later. So that's our real problem. We have people now that are willing to use that kind of threat and make it stick later if the witness doesn't play ball. I propose the committee consider whether or not a Class A misdemeanor should be in fact raised to a Class C felony to recognize this situation. If the judge the option to decide how serious it really was. In both areas of physical evidence sampling and witness sampling. Now, perhaps John, this is covered under coercion.
I think that is.
And if it is, and I think it is, and I think the bomb threat in response to Representative Paulson's book is covered. When you look at the definition of person back in the earlier section, it includes a corporation, business association, partnership. So a store that receives a bomb threat would be covered. That person has committed the crime of coercion. And probably we would charge the police if it's over about the crime of coercion. For instance, the Standard Plaza last Friday was empty because the bomb threat was received. Standard Plaza building was closed between the county courthouse and the federal building. And if the county courthouse the bomb threat is received, it's left up to the department head. You had that decision to make. It'd be pretty easy to tell everybody to go outside and take a long lunch hour. If in fact, tampering with a witness is covered under coercion, tampering with physical evidence of an area of the greatest seriousness, I think that should be considered at least to see whether or not you think it's desirable that that area be covered under a C felony rather than a B felony. Now, the other commentary I have pertains to the disarrest section. We like it. Police like it. But the police aren't sure that they go along with the Michigan revisers. Commentary that passive resistance should not be covered by a resist arrest. For this reason, I think about every other month, some anti-war group chains itself to the door of the draft headquarters in Portland. They don't do anything. They don't fight you. They don't cuss you out. They don't spit on the police. They simply chain themselves to the door. Then they all hold hands, or worse yet, they'll lock arms. They won't fight the police, but it takes a rather husky four police officers to pry their arms apart, and it takes four of them to carry them off to the police wagon and transport them down to the police station.
Is that passive?
That is passive. Well, I don't know. I don't doubt it.
Well, in any event, it isn't obstructing governmental administration.
Probably. Probably.
Because it would certainly be an obstacle, I would think, or a physical interference if you're chained to somebody's office door.
The police certainly consider it an obstruction of governmental administration.
I think that could be prosecuted in Section 198.
Fortunately, the groups recently have been very reasonable and have been offered the opportunity to be placed under arrest. That is, in fact, what they're intending to be done to make their protest known, and the police are very willing to arrest them. Taking down that minimum bail, let them bail out or be recogged by the judge. They've made their voice known, and Captain Ryder of the Central Precinct is very good at this type of discussion with them.
And that's where it ends, generally.
That's where it is. That's what they're there for. The thing that we looked with a little trepidation upon during the Legion Convention was the specter of individuals lying down in front of a parade, locking arms and stalling the parade for 30, 40 minutes until the police were able to remove them. Now, if that, in fact, is obstructing governmental administration, I think the Class A misdemeanor certainly has the coverage for that kind of conduct. If they become riotous, then that's a different ballgame, and we'll tell them to carry. That's basically all the commentary. Sections 207 through 213 are very good. And I'm kind of intrigued by your commentary there, Senator Carson. That is completely passed over our heads.
That's why I waited. I was sure you'd bring it up.
And I'm kind of, I must just say that I think our committee would be in support of some bifurcated penalty structure in this area, of treating a misdemeanor, aider and abettor as a misdemeanor, and felony aider and abettor as a felony.
we'd have to change the language in this hindering. I don't think it would be appropriate. All of us are suspects.
Well, you could do like you do with conspiracy. One conspires to commit a Class A felony, is committed a Class A felony, and right down the line. And perhaps that would recognize the relative seriousness or lack of seriousness.
I think we should give that some
seriousness. You do that.
Sorry about that, Don.
Thank you, Alan.
Rule.
Yeah.
You do have a specific amount of bill for Section 203.
Yes, I do.
Yes, it's in his. It's in his overall list.
And all my specific amendments are now in your hands from now throughout the rest of the book.
Dave, you had something you wanted to.
I'm David Dunaway from the State Archivist. And I'm here specifically about the definition of public records, because I don't think it's that comprehensive enough. Code. I feel that it's a terrific job that has been done, and it's something that I am very much attuned to. I am particularly concerned with the effect of this definition, which is in 107.4, upon Section 205. 205 is a tremendous improvement over the present law in relation to tampering with public records, and the present law actually only relates to the custodian and the lawyers. It doesn't relate to anybody else. And while this is now a general term, a general law that would affect anybody that tampers with public records. Specifically, I would like to question, in the first place, the word the official. There are some states, I believe Illinois is one of them, where they have made the distinction between official and unofficial records, and this has caused all kinds of problems in relation to determining what is official and what is unofficial. And I think it is wiser to have a general definition that the records that are maintained in the government of the office or agency are public records. And I would take out the word official. In the second place, I feel that this definition books, documents, records, or written materials does not take into account that some records nowadays are not necessarily written, which is the case of film and computers. In the medical world, you have, in the state hospitals, you have this thing, the eight charts, you know, which are a chart that is often done on a machine. Is that really written or not? I'm not quite sure. And it seems to me that it would be wiser to use the definition which is in the public record statute 192.055, which includes paper, files, photographs, and sound recordings, and recognizes that the law applies regardless of physical form or characteristics. I think that if we solve that problem, we would never have to argue about the fact that whether something is just because something is in a computer. You can nowadays put material into a computer online. There is no other record. For example, down at the IBM headquarters, the research laboratory in San Jose last year, I saw where they were cataloging the books for the library by putting the information directly on the computer for ordering the books. When the book came back, they checked the book against what was on the computer. They modified it for their cataloging purposes, added subject entries, and anybody calling the information out could call the information out. There was no written record as such, except for what is in the computer as such. And this is, in a sense, what is now developing out of the motor vehicle department. And it seems to me that in the law long run, it's going to be much more important for us that we are able to cover that type of maturity as a public record. It could well be tampered with. Maybe you saw that lovely movie with of the English Communion, and he proceeded to get caught on by a computer as a forger. And so when he got out of prison, he proceeded to learn how to become a computer operator, and he got himself a job in a brokerage house, and figured out how to put in all these transactions and buy all these stocks and bonds. He went all over Europe depositing his money. It was a marvelous movie about computers. So this sort of thing is conceivable. And I think that, therefore, it is very important that this particular problem of the physical form and characteristic be considered. And certainly, the taste that one takes makes session like this is that really covered by this particular section? Could one take a tape and proceed to dub in or proceed to cut out and not be prosecuted under this point? Next point that I think I would like to mention is that records that are received in offices are not just those which are created by or maintained by the office, but they also are received. And then there are the records in the courthouse, for example, and in the Secretary of State's office, which are recorded in the very technical sense that somebody submits a document like a deed and it is copied and so the original is returned. So that I feel that it would be very wise to cover the receipt and the recorded document in this particular definition.
Would it only be covered by maintained?
In a sense, they're maintained, sir, but I'm not quite sure that this is. This is busy. How you have met some lawyers who are, you know, it doesn't actually say that the word is in the word isn't in the law, therefore it isn't covered. And so, it could be a defense. I think that that particular type of recording. It in particular is one of the most important of the public functions of the public office. Then I also feel that the description affording notice or information to the public or constituting a memorial or an act or transaction of a public office or public service is not as comprehensive as in the briefer one in 192.005. It's in pursuance of law or in connection with a transaction of public business, whether or not confidential or restricted from use. And I think that is a stupid and sound definition. These are specifically the amendments that I would suggest to you. I have them out for you for your use.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Dave? Thank you. Don, we'll turn to 25. It's a short. Thank you a lot, Dave.
Mm-hmm. 25, I'm happy to say, is one of our shorter articles in the code. We started off, but we had a few other sections that kind of fell by the wayside. We have two sections on official misconduct, one a Class C misdemeanor and the other a Class A misdemeanor. And the first one is just a question of knowingly violating a statute relating to his office. Again, we're talking about public servants. It becomes more serious if he does this with an intent to obtain a benefit to himself or to harm another. He knowingly fails to perform a duty imposed upon him by law or one clearly inherent in the nature of his office, or he knowingly performs an act constituting an unauthorized exercise of his official duty. Second degree official
conduct in office with these, most of them are in chapter 162. We have 11 statutes that would be replaced either by these sections or sections dealing with the theft or other related offenses where you're talking about misuse of funds or some type of fraudulent conduct.
Don, pardon me, Chairman. In section 182, in our definition of benefit, it means gain or advantage to the beneficiary or to the third person. Do we distort that in 215 when we say with intent to obtain a benefit for himself? Now, if we were to say to obtain a benefit, then clearly it would mean to himself or a third person. What do you mean? When you say for himself, I think that we leave out the third person situation.
Yeah. Of course, one other thing should be noted, and that is in the Oregon Constitution, Section 6 of Article 7 defines that public officers shall not receive incompetency, corruption, malfeasance, or delinquency may be tried the same man as criminal. The judgment may be given a simple office, and such further punishment as may have been prescribed by law. Such further punishment as is the particular section. We don't intend here by these sections 214 or 215 to cover negligence on the part of the public official. Himself, this kind of conduct was best regulated by civil service procedures or, in the case of elected officials, the ballot box. Section 216 deals with misuse of confidential information, prohibits misconduct manifested by speculation or wagering on official action which a public servant in a position of influence or on the basis of confidential information that he has access for official purposes. We don't attempt to govern the public servant with regard to his assessment prior to his public service. This type of thing is action taken on the basis of information he has obtained in official capacity as a public servant. Have any existing laws specifically on this, although there are some provisions in other chapters that cover similar kinds of conduct which deal with the duties of public servants and means of dealing with malfeasance in office and that type of thing. But I would like to mention there were two sections dealing with official oppression. One particularly troublesome section that we discussed at great length in the commission, one covering conflict of interest. The draft section that we had on official oppression covered the public servant who knowing that his conduct was illegal and infringes upon a citizen's personal or property rights or denies another in the exercise of his official capacity any right, privilege, power, etc. Felt that most, that is, the commission felt that most, if not all of this, was adequately covered by the section on official misconduct. And, but like I said, a particularly troublesome area was conflict of interest. We tried several different drafts. We had a number of extremely, we felt, insoluble problems. When the conflict, for example, trying to determine when a conflict existed, who would make that determination of whether there was a conflict? Some states have tried to require a disclosure, say, to the prosecuting attorney or the attorney general. And what kind of a conflict, what standards would you require, really concrete to go on that we should not include such a statute in the criminal code. There are a number of statutes dealing with similar kind of conduct. ORS 198-120, which was adopted in 1969 by the legislature, revised special service district law regarding conflicts of interest. Also, I know that the public utilities code in the state from the legislature has a section. I know that my service as a member of the law improvement committee, that we ran into the very same kind of problems that what a conflict of interest was, and what kind of service public servants you're going to cover. Obviously, the public utilities commissioner should be covered. Any person who's exercising any kind of discretionary authority should be covered. Even there, though, you have the question of qualitative judgment, what constitutes a conflict, and also the other consideration of what about the lesser employee, the person who's performing ministerial services, who, even though they might have a conflict, it's not going to make any difference because they don't exercise any discretion or have any judgment-making or decision-making power anyway. But we pointed out in our commentary, the commission felt that public servants were subjected to always the ballot box, subjected to recall, forfeiture, or lockdown. Public servant under the civil service regulations, that there were internal rules and regulations governing this kind of thing, and that it was just an almost impossible kind of criminal statute to draw. So that's why you find no such statutes in the proposed criminal code. That's all I have on Mr. Charlie.
Mr. Chairman, I keep reading 205 and 216. And the more I read it, the more sooner they seem, particularly after Senator Turley, eliminates the words for himself. And you have two different grades of penalty there, and somewhere or other, I'm at least missing the point.
Well, of course, under your official misconduct, it's just a question of not performing a duty that's imposed on him, or perhaps doing something that he is not entitled to do, whereas under 216, it's directly concerned with the pecuniary type of interest in gaining money or property or assisting some rich person in obtaining some pecuniary benefit as a result of information that the public service has.
And what's the benefit? Cover all that? The word benefit? And then if it does, then it's still valid. Why have three different types of, just supposing you thought the language was necessary, look like they're the same types of.
But you don't use the word benefit 216. Misuse the acquiring pecuniary interest in property transactions. So it isn't necessary. He acquires or aids another acquiring.
Well, I guess what I'm really coming down to, I really don't see, you can nail a guy on one of those, you can nail him on the other.
Well, that happens many times in Western influence, then.
Well, could you nail all people who have broken the law on this area on either one of those,
well,
one or the other?
One is 5A misdemeanor, and the other is
5B. Well, does the prosecutor decide which one he wants to select? Is that the purpose of that? There you go, that's the only difference. The same kind of crime, isn't it?
It's not necessarily the same kind of crime, because of your official misconduct, you're not requiring. In fact, there's nothing said about pecuniary interest in this type of thing. You're talking about failing to do what he's supposed to do. For example, say a district attorney might come under this kind of inspection, as well as, say, the Secretary of State or or anyone else. If he had the intent to obtain a benefit or to harm another person,
there could be official misconduct without any misuse of accommodation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think at this point is the question, can you have misuse of confidential information without having it at the same time being official misconduct? I think you can. I think that and maybe we're straying in that, and I'm not saying there is a difference, but unauthorized exercise of his official duties. Leaking information could hardly be in the exercise of his official duties. He has no duty to leak information. So leaking information, which would be Section 216, is not an unauthorized exercise of his official duties. I mean, I think the argument can be made.
But he doesn't perform his duty. And that's in 16 and 15.
The point being, one of his duty is not to do that.
His duty is to perform his job in an honorable, efficient manner. And that's the obvious.
Yeah.
I don't know, but you probably see the difference. Looks like you should have the same penalty for the one right now. It is.
But there's no question that one course of criminal conduct might violate more than one statute.
Yes, I understand that. But look at the fact that anybody guilty of one would also be guilty of the other to be convicted of the other. That's why I thought the two penalties were enacted.
Well, misuse of information, what other statutes would have the violation of the statute? For example, on official misconduct violating a statute.
No, they have to perform a duty on the one that's before.
No, on sub A, under official misconduct.
Well, it seems to me the 15 covers all the 16 ones in this
kind of. Do you have anything on this one, Dick?
Nothing. We think it's a good section.
Meeting adjourned. We'll have a work session starting with section Article 15 on Friday morning.
I have a record. I broke a tooth. The first appointment I was able to get was Friday morning.